Are vegetarian diets helpful in reducing colorectal cancer risk?
Which is better, a restrictive or liberal transfusion strategy after heart surgery?
What should we do about fractures of the upper arm bone?
And one-year outcomes following transcatheter aortic valve replacement?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. Posted on March 13th, 2015, I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Science Center, El Paso, where I'm dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, since we're so very fond of these diet studies, I'd like to turn first to JAMA Internal Medicine, a study taking a look at whether a vegetarian diet helps to reduce colorectal cancer risk.
Since colorectal cancer remains the second leading cause of cancer mortality in the United States, and we spend a lot of time talking about prevention, usually through screening, the question is, can you also prevent colorectal cancer by perhaps changing your diet? This particular study is good in that it has over 96,000 Seventh-day Adventists who have a variety of diets. Many of them are vegetarians, but there's non-vegetarian. And in this trial, they've been recruiting these individuals from 2002 to 2007, and they're able to look at the relationship between their dietary patterns and the incidence of cancers of the colon and rectum. They identified at least four different vegetarian patterns in this group. Vegans, lacto-ovo vegetarians, they were allowed to eat dairy products. Some were pesco vegetarians, they were allowed to eat fish. Some were semi-vegetarians, that is markedly reduced meat. And then there were some that were non-vegetarians. And what they discovered is over the mean follow-up of over 7 years, all vegetarians combined versus the non-vegetarians had a markedly reduced incidence of colorectal cancer. It decreased by about 22%. And the pesco vegetarians by 44%.
This is, of course, bad news for fish because we already have this issue with overfishing fish. It sounds like, gosh, if you add fish to that vegetarian diet, you can reduce your risk even more.
Based upon the individual's proclivities, there's a variety of different vegetarian diets that can be beneficial. And we know, by the way, that these same diets have been associated with lower mortality, a lower prevalence of obesity and high blood pressure, multiple benefits from vegetarian diets.
So I have to share with you that I've heard it quipped in the past that there in the fine state of Texas, seafood is represented by a cow in a pond. So I'm wondering if this information is going to have any impact on your dietary choices or on those dietary choices you advocate for.
Well, Elizabeth, you won't be terribly surprised to know that, especially as we get older and it's harder to maintain one's weight and health, is that our diets, in fact, do get better. So I already have a limited cow and a pond diet right now.
Okay. Let's turn from here then to the Journal of the American Medical Association. I thought this was a really interesting study. Turns out it's fairly common for older women to fracture the humerus, the upper arm bone. And when that results in displacement of the two pieces of the bone, is it better to do surgery or to use more conservative strategies?
And in fact, this is not only a common fracture in women, but in men as well. A proximal humeral fracture, that is near the shoulder, the long bone of the arm, accounts for 5 to 6% of all adult fractures, which means worldwide there's about 750,000. And most of them occur in older individuals over 65 years of age. About half of them are displaced, where the bones actually aren't aligned fully. Now, over the last several years, there's been an increased use of surgery to treat those. Some of them with internal fixation, they put in rods. Other times there's a total shoulder replacement. And the real question is, are the results any better with that surgery than the previous treatment, which is just to put them in a sling and let the individuals heal? This study recruited 250 individuals, three-fourths of them female, who presented at orthopedic surgery centers in 32 different sites in the United Kingdom. And they were randomized to either having surgical treatment or put the individuals in a sling. The outcome was, how did the patient feel? Did they have complications? Did they need second surgery, subsequent therapy, and even mortality? And what they discovered was that there was no significant difference between the two groups over a two-year period, or even at any of the individual time points, at 6 months, 12 months, or 18 months leading up to the two-year follow-up. So these results actually do not support the trend of increased surgery for patients with displaced fractures of the proximal humerus.
I'm not sure whether I think this is good news or not from a patient standpoint, just because most people, when they learn that they've got a fracture where the pieces of the bone are not aligned, probably would like to achieve some kind of solution that could be employed immediately. And the conservative strategy really isn't an immediate fix.
They assessed not only the outcome of the shoulder, but also how the patients felt about it. And what they discovered was that the surgical group really did no better than those individuals placed in a sling. Because after surgery, you still have some immobility, discomfort, still takes time for it to heal. But again, no difference between the two treatment strategies.
Very interesting. Well, in view of the fact that, of course, it's been brought into my awareness anyway, that this whole shoulder issue is such a big deal as we age, this is good news, I think.
And obviously a much lower cost as well associated with using a sling as opposed to having surgery performed.
Okay. Since we're talking about surgery then, let's stay in JAMA. Something I also thought was really interesting, transaortic valve replacement. And okay, what are the outcomes from that?
This is a procedure that's usually extended to individuals that are older because most aortic valve surgeries, and again, that's the valve between the left side of the heart that prevents blood from leaking back into it after it ejects blood into the body, is that these valves most commonly become dysfunctional in older individuals. The typical patient that has aortic valve surgery had it done in their mid-80s. Well, those individuals oftentimes have a lot of other comorbidities, lung disease or liver disease or kidney disease. So it's a high-risk group. Mounting an artificial valve on a stent, on a catheter, and putting that into the patient without the surgery offers some significant hope and possible advantages. How durable is that? Those were the results that were published in this issue. This was data from the Society of Thoracic Surgery Registry, and this was mandated by CMS. Once these valves were put on the market, and I happen to be a part of the FDA group that recommended they actually be approved, we recommended that all patients be followed so we can get good follow-up. This report, over 12,000 patients in which the procedure was performed at over 300 hospitals across the U.S. In the 12 months of follow-up, outcomes included a mortality of 24%, a 4% stroke risk, and at 1 year of follow-up, the 50% of patients who remained alive had not been hospitalized, and 24% had required one additional hospitalization. These results are very comparable to what one might expect following surgery, but with a procedure that carries a lot less morbidity or risk.
So your spin on that is really interesting because it sounds like, okay, if you're going to have this, you may as well have it by the catheter versus having your chest cracked open.
So these were individuals that the surgical outcome predicted that 7% would have died within 30 days of the surgery. What this information does is it allows the individual assessing which therapy they want to have the complete data set. These are real-world results.
I guess one thing it calls into question, however, is whether somebody who has a multitude of comorbidities ought to have this procedure at all.
That's a great question. You can say, gosh, if you've got all these illnesses, well, what this result suggests is that 3/4 of those patients are alive a year after the surgery, and half of them are doing well. They need no more procedures or not hospitalized again.
Okay. We'll leave that one for now. Since we're talking about cardiac surgery, let's turn to the New England Journal of Medicine. What about those transfusions relative to surgery?
Cardiac patients are thought to be those that are most sensitive to the amount of oxygen in their blood. So we spend a lot of time trying to maximize the amount of oxygenation by maintaining the right level of hemoglobin or the right hematocrit, trying to prevent them from becoming anemic during surgery. Oftentimes they lose some blood during surgery. There are some observational studies suggesting that if you give transfusions liberally, that it increases the risk of infection and actually increases the risk of death. So the proper way to do that is to randomize patients who are having heart surgery to a very restrictive transfusion therapy. You only give it if their hemoglobin drops below 7.5 or hematocrit of about 22, or more liberal when their hemoglobin, say, drops below 9 or hematocrit of 27. And that's what this study did in over 2,700 patients. The hypothesis was that the restrictive therapy would be more beneficial. What they discovered was there was no difference between the two patient groups. Using the restrictive strategy did not reduce the risk of infection, the risk of death, didn't reduce the cost. So you might say, well, gosh, there's no benefit to a restrictive strategy. The flip side of that is you can say, well, gosh, there's no benefit to the liberal one. By using a more restrictive strategy, you can actually decrease by 50% the number of patients that would get a transfusion. And that's a spin I'd like to put on this particular paper.
What about the quality of life measures in these folks?
When they looked at individuals and gave them a questionnaire asking, are you able to take care of yourself and how about your performance of your usual activities and mobility? There was no benefit with regard to a more liberal strategy.
Well, that's, as far as I'm concerned, a really revelatory fact. And as we've talked about before, lots of people describe transfusion as tantamount to an organ transplant. So if we can avoid all the consequences of organ transplant, then that sounds like in somebody who's already going to be experiencing some issues relative to their surgery, sounds like a good idea to me.
And I think that's the case.
Okay. On that good news note then, I'll reveal that the one that speaks to me this week and that I'd like to highlight is the humeral fracture management. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.